Welcome to Business Frontiers in Malta, the program exploring the dynamic world of enterprise, innovation, and economic transformation. This series shines a light on startups and entrepreneurship, powerful forces reshaping how we live, work, and do business in Malta and beyond. From bold ideas to disruptive technologies, entrepreneurs are challenging the status quo and driving global change. We will explore what fuels their journey, how they scale, and the obstacles they face in today's competitive markets. Whether you are a founder, policymaker, investor, or just curious about the frontier of modern business, this series is for you. I am your host, Professor Anne-Marie Take, from the Department of Policy, Politics and Governance, and we are broadcasting from the university's radio station, Campus 103.7. On today's program, we'll be talking with our special guest, Mr. Louis Naudi, who lectures at the University of Malta, diving into the topic, can entrepreneurship really be taught? So stay tuned because you won't want to miss a moment. Mr. Louis Naudi transitioned from academia to marketing early, founding four highly successful service-based businesses over 30 years, the last sold before returning to Malta in 2013. He has won 20-plus UK Business Awards and served as board member of the Ministry of Education's Skill Council and advisor to the Ministry on Entrepreneurship and Trade. His experience includes 12 years as Tourism Board Director and NGO Chairman, implementing a customer-centric customer experience model. A marketing specialist, chartered marketeer, and former CIM ambassador to Malta, his qualifications include Oxford, London School of Economics, Sheffield, Aarhus, and CIM. He has taught entrepreneurship and customer experience at UM since 2019. Louis, welcome.
Thank you.
Can entrepreneurship really be taught, or is it something you are born with?
That's a question I've asked myself over a long period of time. And the conclusion I've come to, it's more important to consider what is the best way to teach entrepreneurship, not necessarily can it be taught. Research shows that successful entrepreneurship training builds new mindsets and perspectives as much as it imparts new skills. So I do believe you can actually teach an awful lot of the particular skills which are needed. Whether it can be implemented by individuals is another matter altogether.
But what do most people misunderstand about what it takes to be entrepreneurial or an entrepreneur?
I've met many people over the years who've approached me with ideas that they've had and are convinced that customers will like what they have to offer, which rather concerns me because the first thing I tend to ask is, what evidence do you have to support that notion? And secondly, do you believe and understand what personality traits are required to become a successful entrepreneur? I don't think many people understand the commitment, the highs and lows, personal characteristics such as perseverance, passion, the long hours. There's a whole range of them which are important, and many actually give up. One of the biggest problems is they don't understand the market in which they feel that they want to get involved with. And an entrepreneur is an initiator, a challenger, and a driver, and somebody who creates something new. Not everyone has that spark.
Let's stop on this for a minute. Is entrepreneurship about starting companies or about thinking differently?
Well, may I just make one point? It's not about starting companies. It's about starting a business. Or it's starting something which isn't necessarily a business. It's an organization. I prefer to use the word in my teaching about organizations, which may include companies, may include charities, all sorts of organizations. So if we're thinking about entrepreneurship, the definition which I'm very familiar with and quite happy with is entrepreneurship is about the pursuit of opportunity. And at the end of the day, it's the definition which comes from Harvard Business School. And it's about a way of thinking and a way of working, and it's about a mindset and a skill set. And the mindset and process needs to create and develop economic activity. So in many respects, you may argue that entrepreneurship is about action rather than just thinking. And it's about an ability to turn ideas into action, creativity, innovation, and risk-taking. And risk-taking is a fundamental part of entrepreneurship, just as much as innovation is.
So why do many startups then fail, even though the idea seems good?
Well, I think one of the things which I would like to mention is I remember an article which was published in the Times of Malta by a well-known individual who clearly argued that many startups fail through lack of funding, and therefore funding was the main issue. I remember countering that and said he didn't know what he was talking about. I tend to be a bit blunt in the way, because at the end of the day, the two key reasons are, one, failure to articulate a clear proposition. In other words, what are you going to offer and to whom, and why they should consider even spending or paying money for it. Secondly, testing that in the marketplace, and also identifying a clear gap and target audience. The major reason is simply lack of research and understanding the customers and whether it's relevant to today's marketplace to meet customers' needs. Those are the major reasons, and that's what the evidence clearly shows, and that's my own personal experience.
Okay, let's move now a little bit to education and universities in general. So entrepreneurship is taught to students at university. What is broken in how universities traditionally teach entrepreneurship?
When I was asked to come and teach entrepreneurship after a meeting with the Dean and the Minister of Education at the university, and would I consider making changes? When I looked at how entrepreneurship was taught at the University of Malta, I said, I will come on one condition. You allow me to simply scrap what currently exists and for me to start all over again. The traditional way of teaching entrepreneur is about how to write a business plan. And writing a business plan is, I think, where the focus is wrong. A business plan, you may argue, can be broken into two areas. One, the proposition and research, which validates the proposition. And secondly, the financial performance expected as a consequence of this. And I suspect the major reason for what's broken is in the first section, when we don't spend enough time proving that there is actually a gap and an opportunity in the marketplace. So what I did is I scrapped everything and I started again. And I focus on very much a different way of teaching than I have done in the past and what was done before in entrepreneurship.
Can you expand on that, different way of teaching? What would you mean?
Well, what I do is several things. The first thing I do is I break my students up into groups of five or six, because one of the things I want to teach them is about team working and team development and how they can develop their particular skills in learning, working in a group. The second thing I do is ask them to identify an issue in Malta, a realistic issue, which needs to be addressed, and also why they think it's important and how they would go about it. And then what I do whilst they're working on a particular project, then I also underpin that with particular areas which are critically important. For example, market research, developing propositions, how to test propositions, etc. And so in the second semester, much of the work we do is in developing this project which they have. And I almost take the role as a mentor, and I work with supporting these individual groups, and they have to come out with a project. And I've seen some really good, relevant work, which we sent off to government departments, which even a minister has said, this is great work. We will incorporate it. And it brings a degree of realism into the classroom, because they have to learn, how do I interview people? How do I extract that information? What do I do with the information? How do I apply it? It's about problem solving.
Okay. This season is all about startups and entrepreneurship. What should universities be doing more of to prepare students for real-world startups?
Personally, I hate to sound arrogant, I think more of what I'm currently doing at the moment, instead of what I call just lectures, and moving away from theory into the practicalities of it, and getting them directly involved so they have to understand what the issues are, what the problems are. There are lots of traditional ways of doing this. I mean, you can have boot camps, which we've started. This will be our third year in April, where we bring in individuals who've started businesses, what they've been through, what to look for. And they work on individual projects, which they then have to present. We can develop incubators, which they used to run at MCAST when I taught there. And very much, I think, trying to get them to what I call gaming, involved in coming up with ideas and presenting those ideas. There's so many different things which can be done. But most of it focuses around, I think, getting them involved. When you get involved, as I've said, in the way in which I teach entrepreneurship, it means that they have to go to government departments, they have to go to organisations, they have to extract this information and then apply that information. And therefore, critical thinking is very, very important in the way in which we develop our students.
Earlier on, you made reference to risk-taking and resilience. How do you teach risk-taking and resilience in an academic environment that penalizes failure?
That's interesting, because in very much a part of the Western world, failure is seen to be something negative. But if you look, for example, in the US, failure is actually celebrated. And it's argued that failure is the bedrock of American capitalism. And if you look, for example, at many of the international companies of today, there is a history that many famous names started off and failed. I mean, where do you start? There's a whole list of them. And one of the things which is important about understanding failure is the positive side, because I think that gives you not just resilience, it gives you more confidence. It's important that you understand from failure, and failure is a word which can mean different things to different people. And I think we have to be very careful, because we have this generic term, failure. But failure is not just simply, my business has failed. There may be other issues which are important. And what is critically important is, what lessons have you learned from any aspect of your business which has failed? And how do you incorporate into your current business model? I, for example, look back at the last business I had, which was for 15 years, and I experimented with different issues, and many of them were very successful, some weren't. And I went back to the drawing board and asked myself, what didn't work and why? And it's the learning element, which I think is a positive side. And if you look at risk-taking is minimized through market research. The whole point is, if you can provide evidence and you can test that, your proposition in the marketplace, this minimizes risk-taking, it minimizes failure or elements of failure, and should give you the confidence to take the next step. I mean, in America, they call it the lean principle, where you go step by step by step by step.
Okay, so you're making an emphasis here on the importance of failure in the entrepreneurial journey. How should people deal with it?
With failure?
Yes.
Some people just disintegrate. At the end of the day, one of the characteristics about being an entrepreneur is perseverance and belief, not only in yourself and your ability, but in it's an attitude that you can succeed, and that has to be measured against the information which you have. failure is something which I have never personally experienced in the four major businesses which I've started, because I've gone through them very carefully. I've built a model which works every time, but I have seen people who just simply, if they fail an exam, they start to disintegrate, let alone a business. And what I've tried to do is get them on the right path in the first place. And so failure is not something you start with, but you do explain that some of the things that they will try may not work, but it's what they do as a consequence which matters in terms of the next step, rather than just give up.
So tell me, what is a mistake you see first-time founders repeat again and again?
Oh, well, it's very much, as I've said before, building a product or service before validating that a real market exists. I use particular case studies taken from America, I won't go through them now, which demonstrates that you can go out and test a product and ask a question. And if you don't ask the right question, you won't get the right information. For example, do you like this product? Yes or no? Great. A lot of people may say yes. Whether they would therefore pay money for it is not the same question, and it's a different question, and that can make a significant difference. And so therefore, asking the right questions, validating it and testing it in the marketplace, and in effect, also not listening to the marketplace and understanding customers' real needs as opposed to perceived needs.
Okay, so at what point should someone stop planning and start testing their idea?
I think one of the things that needs to be done right at the very beginning is once you've identified an idea, and an idea can originate from identifying a negative in the marketplace, i.e. there is a problem or an opportunity in the marketplace. You've identified what you perceive to be a gap. And so therefore, the first thing you need to do is you need to define your core value proposition. What are you proposing to offer to whom and why? And then you identify assumptions. And the next thing you need to do is testing. And therefore, you test on the simple basis that people are prepared to use or pay for that, rather than waiting for a perfect product. And I think once you've identified what is called the minimum value product, and once you've done the initial testing, at that point you will know whether you want to continue or whether you need to go back and do more work.
What do you understand by minimum value product? What does this mean?
It's the minimum which you can offer a customer, the minimum at which they're likely to accept, rather than the total product itself.
Okay.
It's minimum viable product, yes.
What would you say is the biggest gap between what students learn and what founders or startup CEOs face?
Students tend to learn, I think the way in which students are taught is an issue, certainly in class, and it's about knowledge rather than in terms of application to real life problems. And when you consider what students learn and what matters to an entrepreneur, entrepreneurs are involved with learning as they go. They're involved in action, and they develop a background and understanding over a period of time about what works and what won't. Students tend not to get out of the classroom as much and rely on that knowledge. The best thing which we could do is to get them out of the classroom into the marketplace on particular real life projects, which will start to open up their mind and perhaps get them thinking in a different way.
You said get them out of the classroom.
Yes.
Can you give an example of this, of what you may have taught in this respect?
I remember a particular group that I had, one particular group, which was looking at a particular sector, the craft sector in Malta. Very little existed, and yet we have over 3,000 particular businesses. And what they wanted to do was develop a strategy to develop the craft sector in Malta far more and perhaps give it greater attention than it had been in the past. So my students identified a proposition. They identified product areas which they needed to involve themselves. And they went out and asked lots of different small businesses what was missing, what they'd like, what support. And they came back with a strategy, which was then presented to the minister concerned, who asked them if they would speak at their next conference and present their ideas and their research, because very little had actually been done.
Had they presented the research?
Yes, it was very successful. It's only now that they're starting to look again after 3 or 4 years and at this particular sector. I think it's a sector which has not been given enough consideration, personally.
Okay, so this must be really wonderful, that students themselves came up with all these ideas and now have been passed on at the policy level.
It's just one of many. It's just one of many. I mean, we've worked with over 20, 25 different businesses or organisations. I remember for the Department of Agriculture, we came up with a whole strategy to promote animal welfare and the problems with, for example, with dogs in Malta, and where the department itself was going fundamentally wrong. And it was, again, taken on board. The question is, do they have the money to implement what was recommended, although the minister concerned thought it was the right way forward?
An example maybe you can give of their idea to improve that sector?
The minister was going to develop herself, had been offered the development of a website. And the website itself was going to incorporate certain elements. The problem was that the site itself was going to be undertaken free of charge by a design company who didn't actually understand what the issues related to. They hadn't undertaken any research, and the minister didn't have the money at the time. We therefore broke down all of the issues, and from that, we developed a platform which could easily be used across a series of problem areas, which would therefore make a difference. And who was going to gain out of this? Well, two sorts of two constituents, I suppose. First of all, the minister and what she was doing at the time, and also the major problem which we had, for example, with dogs, you know, primarily dogs in Malta. So there are others, if I give a lot of thought to it. But it's not the first and it won't be the last. And we've got some really interesting projects coming up at the moment, which are still in their infancy. But come May, they'll be very refined. And I'm a great believer that students, when they've undertaken a piece of work which is worthy, they should send it off to the relevant bodies so they can learn from them.
Right. Okay. I can imagine the students themselves must really feel proud of the fact that their work and their research has in some way reached the policy level.
Well, I think, yes, I say to them right at the very beginning, don't be embarrassed and don't be ashamed. So you've managed to spend all of this time identifying information from different sources. You don't have any political or other inhibitions or pressures on you. And you can look at this from a different perspective. It's better sometimes from outside looking in than in looking out. It's a difference between what I call a consumer or a sales-led approach.
Okay. So what would you say are the skills that matter most for entrepreneurs but are rarely taught in classrooms?
I think one of the things which I feel very strongly about is the key soft skills. And if you look at the reports, at the PwC reports, the skills which have been mentioned over the last 5 to 6 years are very rarely changed. I think team working in groups, because that reflects or mirrors the way in which organisations are developing their staff internally. Cognitive thinking, trying to think outside the box and not accept the standard way in which people think. And Pitching, for example, you know, many of the students don't know how to pitch. If they don't know how to pitch, how do they pitch themselves when they're looking for a job? Refinement and testing of ideas. I think the area most of all is critical thinking and critical analysis, because we ask them to collect this information. And at the end of the day, what are they going to do with this information? And so therefore, this is what I'm looking for. Ask them to analyze and apply that information, which will lead to what I call sensible and realistic solutions. If they understand the processes involved, theoretically, they should be able to apply this to any particular area, even if they don't have knowledge in it. They can acquire knowledge, but the process itself doesn't necessarily change. It's the one thing which has been with me since I left my first university: critical thinking and critical analysis.
We will now take a short musical break. Please stay tuned to Campus 103.7 to continue listening to the discussion, Can Entrepreneurship Really Be Taught? Before we go, the following song:
I'm Free by The Who. And the reason I've selected that is because one of the key things about entrepreneurship, which has been of fundamental importance to me, is the freedom which it gives you to think and apply. I consider myself to be a creative individual, and I don't particularly do well in organizations which limit that freedom and that creativity. I think that probably comes from my marketing background. And I believe it's been the major reason why, over the years, the same model that I've used has been successful.
Back to Business Frontiers in Malta with me, Anne-Marie Teck. Now let us get into the second part of the discussion. With me, I'm having a conversation with Mr. Louis Naudi, who lectures at university on entrepreneurship. The subject today is about, can entrepreneurship really be taught? Louis, before the break, we were talking about the importance of critical thinking and analysis. For our listeners, can you explain what this means, and maybe you can follow this up with an example?
When I talk about critical thinking, what I am referring to is undertaking research which provides evidence, and then asking yourself, what does the evidence show? How does that evidence relate to your initial proposition? The proposition is a word which I often use, which means what are you providing or what you propose to offer individuals. That's a proposition. Why should they buy from you? How does the evidence relate to that? Does it support that notion, or does it mean that the way in which you were initially thinking needs to be modified? And so therefore, you need to understand the information which you collect and apply it originally to your starting point, because most of the time, your starting point isn't necessarily going to be your ending point. So that's what I call critical thinking. In other words, think very carefully about the information. Have you got the most information? Are you looking at it from a very narrow perspective? And what you then need to do is go out and test that as well, that your thinking, i.e. what you're proposing to offer, is something which people are prepared to pay money for and actually want.
Okay. Do you have any examples or maybe a case study of, you know, what your students would have done in this respect?
You know, over the last 8 years, I probably had some 60-odd projects, and it's not always easy to remember, but there are some which stand out. The one which stands out most of all was by a group of students. And one of the things we start with, okay, come up with an idea. Where is there a problem? And why is there a problem? And how would you perhaps try to tackle that problem? And one of the things, I mean, we, you know, when we're talking, I tell them exactly the kind of problems which I have faced. One group came out with a mobile phone charger, which really surprised me because it was fairly straightforward. And the research which they undertook was amazing. And they found a solution in China. When I go out and I'm sitting out in the sun, I like to read. And when I'm reading, if I'm sitting there for hours, if I don't have a charge with me, which I never remember, then my mobile phone, you know, often goes flat. And as a consequence, I tend to get bored because I don't particularly enjoy going swimming and I don't particularly want to get sunburnt, but I do enjoy the reading. And if that is the case, then we have to carry around sometimes chargers, we have to carry around plugs, we're looking for adapters, et cetera, et cetera. And the students came up with the idea of a phone case in which the mobile phone went into, which had a chip in it, which would automatically, if you're reading, catch the sunlight and charge itself without the need for a charger whatsoever.
So what you're saying is that the actual chip, which is in the case, yes, of the mobile, is like a power bank.
Yes.
I see.
And you wouldn't even notice that there was a chip there. Now, what was really good is that they searched the marketplace and actually found something by a Chinese manufacturer. They even got costings of what it'd be like to bring them to Malta and what the price would be, which really quite amazed me, the level of depth which they went into. I remember that this was presented to a team of outside or external business people at one of the leading accountancy or management accountancy practices in Malta. I distinctly remember the marketing manager said, "That's brilliant. We can give these out as presents. Can I order 500? Okay. And the answer was, yes, we can do it. And that was, but it never materialized. And it didn't materialize because for the students, it was just a project. For the marketing manager, she didn't actually pursue it, but it could have been pursued. It was so relatively simple as well, and what the cost would be. And so, I still think it's something today. I still remember it vividly and think, I wouldn't mind it of buying one of those for myself.
Yes, it's a brilliant idea. I'm surprised nobody has, you know, embarked on it and encouraged the students then to take it, you know, to another level. And the fact that this auditing company that you mentioned, you know, was interested and would have wanted to buy so many, you know, for prisons, would have been ideal. I mean, just listening to you on this story, I would have probably bought one myself as well.
I think there would have been tremendous opportunities. It's not just an opportunity in Malta. There's an opportunity abroad as well for export. It's something which can be done, but it's something which I've not seen necessarily in the marketplace since. If you look, for example, at Apple, one of the things which Apple identified was the length of time before the battery expired. And they were working not on more bells and whistles, which I sometimes wonder the relevance of many of these things, but actually making it last much longer and therefore a more useful tool, because we tend to keep these with us, you know, 24 hours a day. We don't always remember to charge them.
Yes. Okay. Let's move on a little bit now to the importance of soft skills that you made reference to earlier. Today, we also call them transversal skills, right across different disciplines. How important are these soft skills and what are they?
Communication is, I think, one of the most important issues relating to soft skills. One of the things I've realized is that I actually have to teach my students how to communicate, how to pitch. I am so surprised often that when I put them up, because I make them pitch twice in an academic year, once with their initial idea, at the same time also at the end as part of the final project, because it's broken down into different component parts. And they have to learn how to pitch, for example. So communication is really important.
Louis, if I can stop you here, what do we understand by pitching for our listeners?
Okay, pitching is when you have oral or verbal presentation to individuals. So, for example, you could be going to an interview, and many students don't know how to sell themselves. They don't know how to communicate what the key skills are. When we talk about communication, another class that I teach is also how do you send an email? I'm staggered at the amount of teaching which goes into trying to explain to them how do you send an email to somebody who has knowledge or information whom you might want to interview, which is an important part of the work which you undertake. They have to be taught, how do I write an email? I have seen variations, which are so long-winded, that you get switched off. I'm surprised that at this day and age, we are still having to teach them basics. Most of them don't have that knowledge or skill whatsoever. And if you don't have that, it impacts significantly on the work you undertake.
Okay, so when you talk about long-winded, that means they go into a lot of detail, possibly unnecessarily when they write an email to a company or to an organization or to the actual people they're trying to target. Is this what you're referring to?
Yes. So, for example, they'll write to whom it may concern. So who does that go to? Who's going to answer that? They tend to be ignored. In marketing, most people read from left to right. They read what's in the top line on the email. If the message is not important, they don't even bother to open. And so there, most of what's sent is irrelevant. I mean, we're all busy people. I go through my emails without even necessarily opening them, and I just simply delete them. Can you imagine what it's like if you work for a government department or a particular body, an organization? If you're an academic as well, you think of everything which gets sent to you. So communication is important. So the first thing I say to them, identify whom do you wish to speak. Ring up, find out who that person is, find out their title, find out their email address, and then you've got, for example, the right person it goes to. The second thing is, why do you want to speak to them? Because if you don't put it in the top line, they're not going to bother to check. And let's assume that they go, you know, and they open it, then you've probably got 5 to 7, 10 seconds to get across. And they're so long-winded. I am a student at the University of Malta undertaking, you know, a bachelor in so-and-so, and we are looking into the following things. By the time they've written the first paragraph, the respondent has switched off. And you need to be short, sharp, and to the point. And that's what people look. And if you can get that across, I've found that they are more likely to respond positively than they would do otherwise. In fact, that they will actually respond to tell the truth. So communication is really important.
So in a nutshell, it's short, sharp, and to the point.
Yes. Adaptability. Well, for example, I've said, look, if you're very busy, okay, in terms of me coming to you, then perhaps what we can do is have a Zoom meeting. That's just simply adapting, which is easy. You don't have to leave the office. We don't have to leave the university. And we can be flexible about when we hold it, whether it's first thing in the morning or whatever the case may be, and bring other people involved. Emotional intelligence is trying to understand what's really important and getting to understand the issues, perhaps which you weren't necessarily aware of. For example, financial statistics or how to use financial flows is also important. But soft skills can relate to negotiation. They can relate to communication. They can even, you may argue, planning, working in teams. They can include critical thinking and critical analysis. And we look at the soft skills under the PwC reports, which yourself, you know about more than anybody else. And you get to, and you look over the last 5 years and you'll see that sometimes the order changes marginally, but they're looking for very similar skills and that hasn't changed much at all. But negotiation is becoming more and more important. And I also teach, for example, when we talk about communications, when you're, for example, you have the opportunity for an interview, what questions do you ask? How do you conduct the interview? How do you get the information that you want rather than, you know, umming and ahhing? You've got to come up with a story which follows on. So at least the person or persons you're speaking with understand where you're coming from and also the point at which you wish to arrive. And therefore, they can be part in the development of that story and impart the knowledge which you require.
So very often in entrepreneurship, it requires judgment. Would you say that somebody can learn entrepreneurial judgment or only experience can teach it?
You know, I've tried to think about that in terms of my own personal background. Judgment is influenced by both evidence and experience. Experience is something which comes over a period of time, and exposure. We can teach how that evidence is collected and used and applied. And we can use case studies to prepare students as well. But if I look back and think that in my last business, which I had for 15 years, which was a significant journey and required masses, a mass of changes which were required. The way in which I was able to do it was based on prior experience and the judgment based on what I think is likely to happen. We go back again to evidence. So it's a mixture of both rather than just one or the other. It's not one or the other. But there are ways in which we can help to prepare students. But at the end of the day, the only way you're really going to be prepared, as I said, one of the things about entrepreneurs is they're action orientated.
Okay, let's move on now to policy, systems and society in general. So would you say that our education and funding systems reward the wrong kinds of entrepreneurs?
If we look at current systems, they tend to favour standardized, tech-heavy or highly scalable models. This is characteristic at the University of Malta, and they're often referred to as unicorn models. Rather than sustainable, locally focused or social enterprises, we tend not to necessarily incorporate those. My own personal view is that we tend to favour those kind of businesses or organisations which are part of what individuals believe is where the future of Malta lies. I believe that actually undermines entrepreneurship in Malta. And if we look at such countries as Singapore or Malaysia, we should be encouraging for individuals to undertake entrepreneurship across a whole range of sectors. And there's nothing wrong in being entrepreneurial. The more entrepreneurial they are, that could be used if you decide to go back into employment. But I think we tend to focus, if you look, for example, at government funding in terms of help is limited to particular sectors which have been identified and characterized by the government. So if you're somebody who wants to set up a business which doesn't fall within, the guidelines, you cannot get any funding. And if you don't, and those guidelines are also fairly endorsed by universities, especially here at the university. They tend to be scalable or want to be scalable. They tend to be heavy, tech heavy and sustainable. I think there is an argument for looking at a much wider way in which funding can happen. And consequently, what happens is when you focus on those, you tend to therefore not help those who have good ideas, but not they're not tech heavy or highly scalable. So in effect, we create almost like two different societies, those which have, you know, the opportunity and those who could, if developed and trained, could provide reasonable employment for themselves and also for other people. You know, if we look at the number of businesses in Malta, most of them are less than 10 employees. In fact, less than that, over 97 or 98%. And so we should be looking at funding systems which help individuals to become more entrepreneurial, even if they're very small clusters.
So you're saying that the actual schemes themselves should be more open and wider in order to be able to fund those that do not fit the bill?
I think for the university, you've got the question of resources and time. So you have to take that into account. As for the government, if you look, for example, at Malta Enterprise, which is the main government funder, I've long argued with them. In fact, the last time was in December, that one of the things is that we tend to favour only certain types of people, and we should have a much broader range of support to help individuals who don't necessarily want to be employed, but want to do something, have some creative element or some idea which they wish to pursue. And the whole point about education and possibly funding is to give them the knowledge and the skills which would take them to the next level to decide, yes, I do have a good idea. Yes, there is evidence, and give them a more positive outlook on life rather than saying, sorry, no, you don't fit into our one size fits all and that's it.
Okay. Earlier, Louis, you made reference to social enterprises. For our listeners, can you explain what these are?
A social enterprise is one that doesn't necessarily is organized with the profit motive in hand. For example, I work on a Wednesday at the soup kitchen. That's a social enterprise. There is also other organizations which collect and distribute food for those who are in need. There are social enterprises, for example, like FAA, the environment group, which spends a lot of its time not just raising money, but making people aware of what's going on in terms of, I personally think, the degradation of Malta, especially when you go abroad and you think, why can't we be like that? Social enterprises are there for society, not necessarily for a specific group, a narrow group. I've got one group of students who are working, for example, on how can we relate to improving the services provided for those with drug addiction. What can be done by existing organisations? How can we link that together? Can we therefore develop a model which incorporates, or a platform, bringing together the different strands of support and help which makes it easy to identify and then perhaps to be able to relate to and get involved.
Interesting. If I had to ask you, how can universities better connect students with industry, mentors and real customers, what would you recommend?
I'm a great believer in bringing people from outside into the classroom. I've recently been teaching the best part of a new master's degree related to customer experience, which is one of my specializations. And I brought in two industry specialists, and they gave, I think, a realistic analysis of what was going on in hospitality. In fact, one of the students asked if she could therefore work with one of the persons who's the general manager of a well-known five-star hotel so he could learn more. And he was very happy to help. So she's now got herself a mentor. And I think mentoring is something which is very important. That's why I mentor my groups of students rather than tutorials. I think at the end of the day, so guest speakers are very important. Mentoring itself, we are organizing our third boot camp, whereby we're bringing a range of individuals who've started their own businesses or social enterprises, and what issues they faced right at the beginning and what issues they currently face. And also, I think, qualitative research. Qualitative research, for example, with the groups that I currently teach in entrepreneurship, means that they have to go and ask real customers. It is a compulsory part of what I do that students have to identify different parts of Malta, real customers, and ask them real questions to get feedback from customers. It's compulsory. Without that, they cannot pass the unit or complete the project. It brings to light, you know, how people think, because students tend to operate within narrow circles, I suspect, in narrow groups. And so I'll send them to different parts of Malta. They've got a standardized questionnaire, and they ask serious questions. And when they come back, I ask them, what did you learn? Many of them are very surprised by the way in which people think. It's not quite as they assumed it to be. So it opens up their mind, and they start thinking, if that's the case, therefore, etc.
So, Louis, earlier on you talked about government funding, you know, and helping entrepreneurial journeys. What role should government play, and what should it stay out of?
In two words, government should act as a facilitator and create an environment which encourages, I think, education and training for all, for those who wish to consider being an entrepreneur or start a new business or some kind of organization. What it should stay out of? Stop trying to run businesses. If we look, for example, at the UK, we now have a situation, I notice, that the government is nationalising all the railways. Every time they've nationalised the railways, they've gone back into private ownership eventually. Governments are useless and should not even try to run organisations for which they have no direct experience. And many of the people in government don't actually have experience outside of government or in public office anyway. I think they're not necessarily the right kind of people. Sometimes I think they speak a different language.
In your view, is this happening in Malta, do you think?
I'm not quite sure. I have enough knowledge, but in terms of what role government play. So government, for example, in terms of helping businesses, is to provide funding for certain types of business and also at certain stages within the development of a business. So, for example, it will give you money to write a business plan. The problem is that most people don't know how to write a business plan, and what they then do is they get somebody else to write it for them. And if you look at the consultants which are on this supposed list, they all put down business planning because therefore they'll be eligible to help businesses, which means that you don't have ownership because somebody else has written it for you. If you don't have ownership, you can't contribute. And I've had examples of that as well. And I've said, okay, fine, explain what that means. They don't know. I said, if you don't have ownership, how are you going to manage this process? So what role should government play? I honestly believe that we should encourage entrepreneurship and we should encourage becoming an entrepreneurial society rather than limited sectors. As they do in the Far East, I think they're great at what they necessarily do. I think in Malta, it's very limited, it's very focused. And despite the fact that we may not necessarily have enough people to be able to cater in employment sectors, I still think there's lots of hidden talents and possibly opportunities. I meet people every day saying, I'm thinking of doing this. I'd love to do that. I want to be encouraged. I want to learn more about what do I need to do. Well, open a book, read a video. That's not the same thing as being in a classroom when you can listen and ask questions. Could be more boot camps. But I do believe, and I've said repeatedly to the powers that be in terms of policy, we need to provide what they did, I think, 5 or 6 years ago in Malta Enterprise, which provide training courses for those people who want to be what I call entrepreneurs. And they stopped it.
A pity. So, Louis, my last question to you. What is one piece of advice you wish every aspiring founder would take seriously?
I think I would just want to repeat what I said earlier. If you want to start a particular business, let's assume it's a business rather than a social enterprise, then you've got to go through various steps. Many people don't have the patience and they trip up along the route, which is one of the reasons why 70% fail within a short period of time. Articulate what you want to offer and be clear about why you want to offer the particular good or service. Identify on the basis of, if we go back to the first step, you've identified a problem or you've identified an opportunity. If it's a problem, define the nature of the problem and all the facets related to that particular problem. That will give you a much better understanding rather than perhaps looking at it from a very narrow perspective. In terms of the opportunity and the problem, because with problems, these can lead to opportunity. If you therefore see things in a positive way, then the next thing is articulate what you would like to see happen and the assumptions which underpin it, and consequently, undertake market research to learn as much as you can and consequently test whether there is a gap in the marketplace and also whether people are prepared to pay. And I use the word pay, not whether they like it and whether it's relevant to today's marketplace to meet customer needs.
Louis, that is all the time we have for today's programme. I wish to thank our guest, Mr. Louis Naudi, university lecturer, for taking time out to accept our invitation. I would also like to thank Marka Juice for the technical assistance of this program. Thank you so much for tuning in to Business Frontiers in Malta. I am Anne-Marie Teig from the University of Malta, and it's been a pleasure spending this time with you.